Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives.
Tis.
And this is the second week of Women's History Month.
Woo-hoo!
And this is a subject that I know that you really wanted to do.
Yeah, so originally I wanted to kind of do like a different country of feminism every week, and then I wanted to do a forgotten feminist, which kind of threw it off. So I really wanted there to be an episode where, because we talk so much about the American feminist movement. So
yes.
I was really fascinated about feminism in other countries, and I thought it'd be really interesting to kind of look at one country in particular and kind of go into their history. And Ireland has kind of been in the news a few times. We've talked about them in
yes.
many episodes, and I know that feminism has played a big role in their country. So
and you're Irish.
And I'm Irish. My name is
and
Madigan Haggerty.
St. Patrick's Day is coming up.
That's true.
I know that Irish people are probably like, oh my God, I don't give a fuck about St. Patrick's Day, because I think Americans really take that on as being
yeah.
like...
It's like a party holiday.
Yeah, Irish Americans are really the ones. That's what St. Patrick's Day is for.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally. So our American listeners are going to love it. So we are going to dive right in into feminism in Ireland.
Yeah.
So kind of where my notes start is with Easter Monday. In 1916, this man named Patrick Pearse read a promise of equality. He declared to end the British rule, guaranteed religious and civil liberty, equal rights and opportunities for all citizens, and universal suffrage. And this was, Keegan just took a sip of whiskey and shuddered.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I decided, I'm like, we're doing Irish feminism, so I'm going to pour some whiskey and have whiskey while we record. And
did you mix it, or is it just straight whiskey?
I did not. I just put, like, an ice cube in it, and, like, my ass was just like, Keegan, you're basically a professional drinker. You can do this, no problem. And I can, but I will be sipping it slowly.
So,
anyway.
Fun fact about Irish Madigan here, can't hold my liquor. Can't do it. I probably
didn't get those genes.
I'm probably the only Haggerty in my family. Like, my mom would talk about going to funerals that would end in, like, brawls.
Oh, Anthony's
on that
family,
side of the family
is, like, okay, so my fiance is half Irish, half Filipino, and both sides can drink like crazy.
Yeah.
And I come from a family that doesn't drink, really. So
okay.
It is insane. When I'm around his family, like, it's like they don't even get fazed, like,
yeah.
at all.
Yeah. My dad's side is definitely drinkers. My dad's an alcoholic. Like, that shit's just in our blood, and it just totally missed me, because I am the biggest lightweight you'll ever meet. So, back to what Patrick Pearse was saying. He was talking about universal suffrage, and since this is 1916, it's interesting because this is 2 years before British women got the right to vote. So,
right,
it was really, like, a big deal for him to say that there was going to be universal suffrage.
Right, so this is 1916, and in 1918 is
yes.
when not only British women, but also women in Ireland, because along with the rest of the UK, they received the right to vote. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a little bit.
Yeah, well, what my next note is here is that you could vote in 1918 if you were a woman over 30.
Right.
And had qualifications.
Yeah, I put those in quotes too. Proper
yeah.
qualifications,
like,
which I don't know what that means.
Or university constituencies.
Right, but men, on the other hand, just
had
to be
21.
21. There were no qualifications involved.
Yep.
So it's kind of interesting when you put this side by side with the United States and the way that our suffrage movement happened. So while women in the UK, including Ireland, received the right to vote first, so in
yeah.
1918, whereas white women, let's be honest, in
yeah.
the United States in 1920, so 2 years later, when the 19th Amendment passed, that's when they received the right to vote. So while it happened sooner in the UK, there were weird limitations on it that there weren't
yeah.
in the United States. So,
well, and as we're going to talk about it throughout this episode, because you can't really talk about Irish government without talking about the Roman Catholic Church.
Oh, yes.
And so there's a lot of that going on. So
it's what makes it so bananas. Like,
yeah.
I don't mean to say that. I don't mean to, like, undermine anybody's culture
I
or
mean, I
religion.
I was raised Roman Catholic, and I'm gonna tell you right now, it's fucked up.
It being anytime a religion is so deeply tied up in the government of a place,
yeah.
it was kind of the same way that I felt when I lived in Utah. Whereas, like, anytime a religion is so tied up in the government,
it affects everything.
It's bizarre. And, yeah. it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the things we're going to talk about today in terms of, like, women's reproductive rights, especially, and, yeah. like, and rights within a marriage, I think are deeply, deeply tied to Catholicism.
They really are. So really quick before we move on, I wanted to bring up that in 2016, there were historians that researched the stories of 77 women who were jailed for participating in the uprising on Easter Monday, which I thought was really
fascinating. In what year?
In 2016. Historians went back and they researched,
They researched
these 77 women who were like a part of the Easter Monday Rising.
Cool.
Yeah, and I thought that was really cool.
Very cool.
So in 1922, the government granted equal rights, but this breakthrough really didn't last very long. So there was this guy named Eamon de Valera. He was originally like Robert and then Edward, and then he was Eamon or Eamon,
sir,
however you want to
say it. My God.
He was some, like, political prisoner at one point, and, like,
so you're saying he probably would have been, like, insufferable on, like, Tinder.
Oh, insufferable.
He would have been, like, one of those fucking, like, hipster guys. He probably waxes his mustache.
I mean,
he wears
either that
a
or,
beanie.
Like, at this time he had, like, he waxed his beard and just had the real, like, hipster mustache.
Yeah, like, no thank
so
you.
So he was super, super, super conservative, and he would adjust the laws away from equality. So we've got the Roman Catholic Church and we've got Eamon or Eamon de Valera, who
right.
are working fucking together in the Irish Free State.
This is very interesting. So in 1922, the Irish Free State gave equal voting rights to men mm-hmm. and women. So you'll see, like, in 1918 is when that law was passed for women to be able to vote, but you had to be 30 and all
yeah.
of those extra qualifications. In 1922, they gave equal voting rights, but
there's loopholes in there.
And in the next 10 years, it's weird. It's like they regressed.
They
it was
did.
Very strange.
Yeah, they eliminated women's rights to serve on juries, working after marriage, which was the marriage bar, and then working in industry. And a really interesting quote from Eamon. I'm going to go with Eamon. Is that cool?
Sure.
So I don't have to say
yes,
his name
yes.
both times. Okay. But it's E-A-M-O-N. Would that be
Eamon? I feel like that's Eamon.
I'm going to say Eamon. Okay. So Eamon says,
I low-key like that name, which is kind of a bummer.
I do, too.
Because he seems
it's
like
an
a
Irish
dick.
Name. I'll forget about it, and then I'll love it again. Okay. So he says, the state recognizes that by her life within the home, woman gives the state support without which the common good cannot be achieved. The state shall therefore endeavor to ensue that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labor to the neglect of their duties in the homes.
Oh, my
like,
G, thank you so much.
I know, he's like, I'm going to do y'all a favor.
Oh, my God, thank you so much.
You don't have to worry about working. You don't have to worry about any of that.
I fucking hate that.
You're giving your duty to the country by staying the fuck home
that
and keeping
is the
your
most
lips shut.
Gaslighty shit.
It
for
is.
You to introduce that to me as if you're doing me a fucking favor.
Yeah.
There might be nothing I hate more than,
yeah.
like, introducing something that I don't want as if you're doing me a favor.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate that shit so much.
Yeah. So, like I said, he was very much in it with the Catholic Church. He had a lot of the same ideologies. So the church also controlled many of the state's hospitals, schools, and was one of the largest providers of social services.
Separation of church and state.
Okay. So now we're going to get into
that was really pretty. We harmonized at the end.
It was
great.
Pretty good. I'm impressed.
Yeah.
So we're going to kind of get into the second wave a little bit because that's all I have on before the second wave. Do you have anything else to add?
I do. So
I have a lot of other stuff to add from other parts, but.
Okay. I mean, I'm sure we will get to it. Yeah. Okay. We can just move through.
Move through. Okay, cool.
And I'll
go
back.
So in the 70s, the second wave began mostly with housewives.
Yes.
And they started the Irish Women's Liberation Movement.
In 1970.
In 19...
I believe.
Yep. And then,
in 1970 is when the Irish Women's Liberation Movement began.
Yeah.
And then it was in 1971 that a group of Irish feminists, and they were mostly from this movement, the Irish
yes.
Women's Liberation
Thank you.
Movement, they traveled. I loved this detail. And I'm sure there's more that we're going to talk about, but this detail cracks me up. In 1971, a group of Irish feminists, mostly members of the Irish Women's Liberation Movement that was established the year mm-hmm. before in 1970, they traveled to Belfast, Northern Ireland, which, listen, guys, if you are listening from Ireland, I am so fucking sorry because I am going to get some of the history wrong. Like, it,
oh, for sure.
There
we,
has
don't know
been,
what the, we don't know what the fuck we're talking about. We've never had a day of Irish history in our lives.
Exactly. And I know very, very fucking little.
Yeah.
Most of it probably from U2 songs.
But this fucking fascinates
us. And Cranberries songs. The combination of Sunday, Bloody Sunday and the song Zombie by the Cranberries is probably the majority of where my education has come from. But in 1971, this group, they traveled to Belfast, Northern Ireland on what they called the Contraceptive Train.
I want to take a ride on the Contraceptive Train.
It's hilarious. So they went to Northern Ireland. They got condoms and then they brought them back into Ireland because condoms were fucking illegal.
Yes. So,
which is such a Catholic thing to do.
It's so Catholic. So this is kind of my lead in my notes to birth control and abortions. So we're going to start with talking about some birth control. Did you read about McGee versus the Attorney General?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so...
this is fascinating.
So fascinating. So, a 1974 case involving Mary McGee, who was a woman who was warned by doctors that another pregnancy could end her life. So she was instructed to use a diaphragm and spermicidal jelly. So I was in the, like, reproductive aisle of Target yesterday because I was getting, like, pads and tampons and stuff and
does
just, like...
spermicidal jelly work?
Yeah. Sorry, this is too much information, but I used to...
Never.
I used to...
Never is.
Hi, my name is Madigan, and I'm here to share all my dirty
secrets. We have
secrets.
A podcast?
I know, but like, okay, so there, it looks like a big Listerine strip, and it's clear, and it's got like spermicides on it, and you insert it within yourself before you have sex, and it dissolves, and it like lasts for a certain amount of time.
I feel like that would sketch me out so bad, as far as like, I wouldn't feel secure.
Well, as we talked about, I can't take birth control.
Right.
So I've kind of gotten creative with my uses of birth control. So I was in the aisle the other day and I was looking at those again. And then I realized they have this thing where it's like a jelly, but it's in like a tampon applicator. Because I'm going to tell you, getting that film inside you and having it not stick to your finger or like, it's just not sexy either.
You're like, I'm sorry, hold on one second. You put your leg up on the wall.
No, you need like the other person to do it.
No.
Sorry, Mom. That's what I had to do. I'm like, can you help me out here? But this is like, it's like a tampon applicator that's got the gel inside of it. So you just like suck that shit into you.
That seems better.
I know. I'm kind of looking to try that. Anyways, so, sorry, Mom. My mom doesn't give a fuck. So, Section 17 of the Criminal Law Amendment, by the way, we're back to Mary McGee. So, Section 17 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act prohibited the prescription, which I'm like, that's kind of progressive of the doctor to be like, I know this is against the law, but, like, I'm going to give you this prescription.
But, like, first, do no harm. I'm trying to fucking save your life because another baby could kill you.
Well, but that's the thing is that the Catholic Church would then just say, don't have sex, you know?
That or they would say that that's God's will.
Yeah, same. I mean,
for you to die.
When I was growing up, I mean, it was very much believed that you don't have sex unless it is for the purposes of making a child. So,
see, I don't know. I grew up in a far more evangelical type of Christianity, and I don't know that the advice to a married couple would be not to have sex. I think it would have been something which is more dangerous, which would have been to continue doing whatever you want, and God's will is God's will, and predestination, and if you are, he will see you through. So if you...
Right, so I mean, I'm saying this as like a very Old Testament type of Catholicism, but also a lot of the Catholicism that I was raised with, I very much with the churches that I went to believe that, especially in middle school, because it was like old school, Old Testament, Latin masses.
Yeah.
So the Supreme Court actually ruled 4-1 in her favor and determined that married couples have the constitutional right to private discussions on family planning. So like, not a
private
huge
decisions,
progressive
yes.
leap, but definitely also a pretty big leap. So
yes, so they basically ruled that, you know, if you're married, you can make a decision how many children you want to have and to kind of like work that out. And beyond that, that you should have, it was kind of the first step in women getting agency.
Yeah.
Over their own health in regards of like...
Right, but only if you're not, married.
Only if you're married. Yes, but it was a step.
Oh,
it was a
totally.
Step and it
I'm
was
not
like...
taking that away.
Yeah, and it was like not only for family planning purposes, but also for your health.
Yeah.
Having another baby would kill you, possibly.
Yeah.
Like, very likely. So it was kind of the first tiny itty-bitty baby step in women having control over their own reproductive health.
Totally.
And lives in that way, because before it would have been like, well, if you die, you die. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
Which is crazy because we're in the 70s.
Yes.
So in 1979, the Health Family Planning Act allowed the sale of contraceptives in Ireland with a prescription. So if you wanted a condom, you had to go to the doctor and be like, yo, what's up? Can I have a condom? I don't know if it was condoms precisely. I'm speculating. And then in 1985, that same act, the Health Family Planning Act, allowed the sale of condoms and spermicides to people over the age of 18 without a prescription. So it took like 6 years for you to be able to get that without
but,
a prescription.
I mean, just think about that. What year was that? 1985?
1985.
I mean, that, so many of these things I had to kind of put in parentheses, like, what the fuck?
Because
I'm just like, you think of that year. My mom graduated high school in 1985.
My mom got married in 1972.
That is, 1985 is 5 years before I was born. Like, that is bananas that you could not get a condom without a prescription from
totally.
A doctor.
100%.
In 1985.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That is so crazy.
Yeah. So, and then in 1992, the 13th Amendment was passed specifying that the protection of the right of life to the unborn does not limit freedom of travel in and out of state. And I was going to leave this out, but I'm like, could pregnant ladies not travel?
I don't understand what that means.
Okay. I just want to bring it up because I was kind of like, what?
Listeners, if you have any clarity on that,
let us
please
know.
Write us in. Like, yeah. Write us in. Please write into us.
Yeah.
Wow. I've had 2 sips of whiskey. Great.
She's feeling frisky.
Off to a good start.
All right. So I'm kind of on to abortion next. Do you have anything else to add when it comes to birth control? Because I guess it kind of ties in together.
My notes are chronological and not by subject. So it's a little more difficult. But yeah,
so
go ahead.
I'm going to be the rule book here. Yeah. So we were just talking about 1985. We're going to go back to 1983. That is when the infamous 8th Amendment was passed, which recognized the unborn as having equal rights to the mother.
Yes. Yes. Which is crazy. To say that a fetus has equal rights.
Yeah.
To a living, breathing, operating, functioning right. human being.
Do you think that if, like, somehow, like, men were pregnant, that it would be, well, then maybe men would be treated like women.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I feel like,
I mean,
would
I
be
guess,
like,
I don't know. If we're talking about a reality in which everything is exactly the same, except for that men can have babies, abortions would be available everywhere.
Yeah.
Immediately.
They would, like, have a beer in the waiting room. And
morning
be like,
after pills, birth control pills, that shit would be available, I mean, just...
Left and right. It would just, be in the vending machines at work.
It would be, exactly.
Yeah.
So, I truly do believe that.
Yeah. It is really, I mean, it's not shocking to me because it's a lot of the reality that I was raised in. You know, I know a lot of those people who believe all of that. So, it's not shocking, but it's also kind of like 1983. Come on now. So, abortions could only be done legally if done as a medical intervention to save the life of a pregnant woman. And later, that risk included suicide, which I'm kind of like, okay.
So her mental health is being taken into account
yes,
here.
Yes, like that's great, you know, whatever. So in 2012, there was a case with Savita, I'm sorry, I'm going to say her last name wrong, Salapanavor. She died 4 days after a complete miscarriage, which led to international protests calling for review of the abortion laws in Ireland. This is 2012.
Right.
This is almost
recent.
20 years later, mm-hmm. you know? So then the government introduced the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act in 2013, and that year the first legal abortion was carried. And then in 2012, so that same time that that happened, the Abortion Rights Campaign, or the ARC, was formed. And it was a grassroots movement, and by 2017, the ARC march had 40,000 people present, and they had multiple regional groups, up to 36 by 2018. They all had kind of that non-hierarchical, very feminist mm-hmm. Belief system, which was really wonderful. And they did a lot of good when it came to repealing the 8th Amendment. And in 18. Yes.
Yeah. I believe it was last year.
Yeah. It was because we talked about it on the mini episode.
Mm-hmm.
So the 8th Amendment was repealed. And effective in 2019, the Health Regulation of Termination of Pregnancy Act came into effect, which defines the circumstances and processes where abortions may be legally performed, termination up to 12 weeks, risk of life of fetus or mother before or within, and this part was weird to me, 28 days of birth? What does that mean?
Before or within 28 days of birth.
Like they're going to kill a baby.
I mean, that's not possible. That's what that means.
Wikipedia, what the fuck?
I don't know.
I don't understand that. So I wrote it down to see if maybe you would have some clarity, but apparently
will you read
not.
That again?
It says that that you could have an abortion, sorry.
Up to 12
up
weeks.
Up to 12 weeks, or if there was a risk of life of the fetus or the mother before or within 28 days
of birth. Do they mean a risk of life for the mother within 28 days after birth? Like, if she could give birth successfully but then die after? Is that what that means?
I don't know, because to me it sounds like these are the circumstances in which we will give an abortion.
Right, but it says risk of life for the fetus or the mother before or within.
So does that mean that even before 28 days of giving birth, the baby could be aborted? Because that seems a little absurd to me. You're almost done.
Yeah.
You had a whole stretch. A baby could be born at that point.
I have no idea. Again, if you have clarity, please write us.
Fucking please. Because, I just wrote
shit down.
Because,
again, I feel like this kind of... It's the same thing that happened in New York recently with their abortion laws, where I feel like this kind of, like, weird, vague language gives pro-lifers the excuse that they need as far as saying, like, look, they're talking about killing babies. They're talking about murdering babies, which is not ever the case. Like, that is not the situation that's happening here. In fact, late-term abortions, the only reason why it would happen is if the baby cannot survive or the mother cannot survive.
Yeah.
It does not happen for any other reason. Nobody goes. And it's so fucking absurd to think this is anything else, because no person who doesn't want to have a child goes that far into their pregnancy and then they just wake up one day and they're like, no, you know what? I don't think so.
Yeah.
Like, nobody does that. They would only do it. And in fact, it's probably the most heart-wrenching, awful moment of their life.
Exactly.
To have to make any kind of decision like that.
Yeah, I think it's very few people who can do that without really having an emotional reaction to it. I know for myself personally that I'm not here to say that I love you with your fucking Lindor
chocolates, like, shoved into every pocket.
I fucking love you. So I'm not here to say that I would never have an abortion, because I think that it would tear me apart, but I also understand a lot of times why people do it. And I think that it is something that people really grapple with and struggle with. It is a huge decision to make, and you have to think about how you're going to feel afterwards and everything like that.
And if you don't, because I also think, you know, within the parameters that we typically have abortions, I think, like, if you just don't want to have a baby, if it's just not conducive to your life right now, that's an okay reason, too. I don't think that it has to be this. We have this perfect image of what it looks like for someone to make a decision to have an abortion. And I don't think it needs to look like that. Like, I don't think it needs to be this thing that's, like, super, even though I think it would be for me, I don't think it needs to be for every woman that this thing that's super difficult.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying when it comes to abortions that maybe people will think are, like, late-term abortions, and they're just like, you're murdering a baby. Nobody wakes up that far into a pregnancy and is just like, you know what,
never mind.
Like, nobody does that. Most likely, the most likely scenario is that this was a baby that was wanted.
Yeah.
And there were circumstances outside of the control of the mother or the family that made this happen. So I just think people need to look at these situations with a lot more compassion and empathy.
Yeah. And one thing that I think about a lot when I think about abortion is, especially when there are children conceived out of rape.
Sure.
I think that's something that the Catholic Church doesn't think about a whole lot, or they're like, oh, like, you know, you still have to love that child, things like that, but it's not putting into the concern of a lot of incestual rape. That is a big reason I feel like that people would want to get an abortion if they were in a situation like that. Rape in general, like carrying that child for 9 months, that is putting your mental health at risk for a lot of people.
Right. I mean, and you can point to circumstances where that wasn't the case, but not everybody is set up like that. Like, not everybody is set up to be able to handle that.
Of course not. And that's why, you know, I think that the misconception a lot of times of being pro-choice is being pro-killing babies.
Well, you know what, though?
Which is not true.
But on the other side of that coin, and I know we've gotten off topic in talking about abortion.
We have so much time. I only have a page and a half left of notes here.
In general, but on the other side of that coin, it's like, there are a lot of reasons people can choose to get an abortion, and it might not be a reason that you deem viable. Because I think a lot of people, even people who are anti-abortion, will make exceptions for rape or incest or health.
Yeah.
But there are other factors to consider, as in, if you are in poverty or you have been raised in poverty and you don't want to bring a child into the world that you cannot support.
Yeah.
To be pro-life and then be also anti any kind of system that would help people who are in poverty.
Well, and then also a lot of times people would argue that there is adoption, the foster system, which is a horrible system.
Adoption's really hard. It's way harder than people acknowledge that it is.
It's not just like, oh, put it up for adoption.
It's super difficult. The foster care system, I know people who foster, God bless them, but that system is really hard on kids.
Yeah,
it's really, really hard on kids, and it's really, really hard on families. Like, it's really hard on families who want to foster. So, and it's oversaturated right now. So for you to say, like, you can just put your kid up for adoption or into foster care,
you're setting that kid up for a lot of
potential
emotional turmoil.
Right, and I'm not saying that 100% of the time the 100% of the time the thing that you should do is abort that child. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying, like, these are considerations that people have.
It's pro choice.
Right, when they're faced with this decision. And so to be, to kind of tie it back into Ireland and, like, what we're talking about here, to be anti-contraception, anti-welfare programs, and anti-abortion, you are saying that women have so little agency in what they can decide to do. If you want to be anti-abortion, you need to be pro-contraception.
Yeah.
Like, period. Because, and you also need to be pro giving out, like, some kind of program to help mothers or women who are in a position to not financially be able to support
a
child.
Think about who was running a lot of the social services. The Catholic Church.
Exactly. And they're going to be anti, it just doesn't make any sense. You are just, to be honest, and I'm going to say this very plainly, if you are against contraception, against any welfare programs, and against abortion, all of those things, if you're against all of those things, and you're just anti-women, like, you're just anti-women because you're leaving women.
I think that's a really great way of putting it.
With no choices.
There's
like
no
agency, they
like
just have no choices.
Yeah. It's
legally.
Like, it really is. It's like, it's that thing that has been said to me a million times where it's like, well, just put it in God's hands. Put it in God's hands. And I, for one, again, sorry, Mom, saying this a lot this episode, I think that's bullshit.
I agree.
I think that's complete bullshit. I think that you can't always just put blind trust in something
And
believe that it's going to work
and
out.
And I'm going to touch on this because I know that they don't listen to this podcast, so I'm not going to, like, hurt their feelings. But I do have a family member who, you know, something really bad recently happened. Her house burned down. And then I was talking to my mom, and she's been at this job that she hates working with these. She loves the kids, but she's been working at this job that she hates for a long, long time. It's very far away. She spends a lot of money in gas. My mom recently told me that she made like $11 an hour and she's been there for like 16 years and she wants to leave now and she has no benefits because she's working for a nonprofit. So she's been making $11 an hour, driving, spending however much money in gas ever. So she's living on very, very, very little and now she wants to leave in her 50s and she has no benefits.
Yeah.
And when I asked my mom why she didn't leave and get another job, she told me, well, she thought that God was calling her to stay at this job and work with these kids. And I can understand that. But I also think that very often God is kind of used as an excuse not to make yourself uncomfortable or make changes.
Yeah. And I get that God a lot of times can be and I'm sorry that we're diving so far into religious talk, but I feel like you can't really talk about the Irish government without talking about the Catholic Church. But I feel like a lot of times it is a way for people to feel comforted in situations. Like you said, someone's house burning down, as like this is God's plan, a way for me to, I'm going to get out of this, yada, yada, yada. But I think which a I lot think of times...
positive, trying to see things as an opportunity, which I understand.
I definitely see the positive side of it. I'm not completely shitting on the idea. But in terms of what your mother said, in terms of a lot of things that I hear from my family, I personally call bullshit.
I've had
a lot of really interesting conversations with our friend Ariel, who owns the Swallows Flight. We've done some live shows for her company. Love her dearly. She was also raised in a very religious family.
Bonded over that.
Exactly. And it's interesting because she's, you know, brought it up as a lot of other people have about how it's like, how can I believe in a God who would agree to all of these things and see all of these awful things happening, when sometimes it's like, you know, back in the day, your kid is sick. Well, that's God's will. I guess he's going to die. It's like, no, you make a choice to create your own fate.
Right.
You can't just leave it up to a higher power all the time.
And you can believe in a higher power and also believe in yourself. Like, yeah. I don't think that they're mutually exclusive.
I completely agree.
I definitely think that whenever I was highly religious, I put a lot of my, I would decide whether subconsciously or not that something was God telling me something because I had a feeling. And I think that it was very often the thing that made me feel less uncomfortable. So staying at a job, how do you justify staying at a job that you don't like, that doesn't pay you well? Well, God wants me to be here. And that stops you from ever having to do anything else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's interesting. So I have this cheesy Beatles lyric that I carry with me whenever I'm feeling stuck in life or feeling like life isn't taking me in the direction that I want it. And that's a lyric from All You Need Is Love that says, there's nowhere you can be that isn't where you're meant to be.
Yeah.
So maybe the Beatles are my higher power.
Yes. They're just leading you through life.
They're leading you through life. So with all that.
Okay, let's jump back in. So sorry.
Do you have anything else you want to talk about when it comes to birth control and abortion?
No, not right now.
Okay. Because we can kind of go through my notes, and then if we want to go back and talk about some other stuff, I say we do that.
Okay, so let's jump to marriage?
That was my
next thing. Perfect. I figured you were going to marriage. Okay.
Boo-boo. So prior to 1981, a man could sue... Well, first of all...
Let's go all the way
all
back.
All the way back.
So let's go all the way
all
back
the way
to
back.
1932.
Yes.
So in 1932, the marriage bar was introduced.
Yes.
And it prevented any married woman from working in the public sector, which is, again, insane. insane.
Like,
and
this is when you're like... Amen would say, you're just doing your duties.
And this is when you look at American feminism and you're like, well, at least it wasn't that. I mean, like, at least women in the 30s could legally have jobs.
And divorce and remarriage was illegal from 1937 to 1995.
It's bananas. And so there was a provision in Article 41.2, and I can't remember what year this was. I think it was in, 1937, there was a constitution, Article 41.2, and it said, one, the state recognizes that by her life within the home, woman gives to the state a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. Did you say
which
this already?
I said... Amen Eamon's version
of
that.
Oh, we'll just cut that out then.
No, but it's interesting because it shows, you know, even if it's the relatively similar quotes, I think that it shows how vastly believed that was.
Right.
You know, it's not like it's just one dude's conservative opinion.
Literally written into the Constitution in 1937.
Exactly. And that's the thing, is that it isn't like it's one person's ideal. It was definitely like, that was the way that a lot of people, especially men, thought. And a lot of women probably had to continually tell themselves, well, like, this is God's plan. This is what I'm meant to be doing. It's just staying home and birthing babies and taking care of them and cleaning the house, because this is my duty to the state.
So from 1932 to 1973, the marriage bar existed. And again, that marriage bar is that a married woman is not able to work outside the home. So you're talking about 41 years. 41 years this existed. It was not until 1973 that the marriage bar was lifted.
And like we said earlier, it's interesting thinking about like our lives and our parents' lives, because I think of my mom. So my mom was married in 1972. She was 21 years old. And that's kind of when she like started her own career and doing a lot of things like that. It's just interesting to think of my mom. Yes, this was 72, so it was the year before this was lifted. But it's interesting to think of somebody like my mom being told, no, you can't do that. You know what I mean? It's just, it's weird to think that it was that recent, you know?
I mean, and it would have been difficult because for me, that's such a huge incentive to not get married.
Yeah.
I'm like, because you're completely limiting my agency. Whether I want to work or not, I should have the option to be able to decide that for myself.
Right. Well, and then there was something too, and I forgot to write this down, but I wrote it in my original notes where the woman's income after this would be melded with the man's income.
Yes.
So it would be seen
for,
as
quote unquote,
his income.
Tax purposes.
For tax purposes. Yes. Yes. It wasn't her own money, which, I mean, when you're married, typically, you know, my money is your money. It's that kind of situation.
But right. But legally, like,
your income is still your own.
I have my own, even though I'm in a long-term relationship, we're engaged. We haven't discussed what we'll do after we get married, but like, my income is still my income.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, anything that I want within what I have earned for myself outside of shared expenses, like, you know, apartment or whatever, any shared assets,
things like
bills,
that.
Is mine. Like, and I just cannot imagine legally it being an obligation, and this had to have been after the marriage bar was lifted in 1973, because
they
before
still had
that,
to make regulations.
Married women couldn't work even work at all. So they're saying even whenever they've lifted that, when married women are able to work, they have to give up all of their income sometime in the 70s and 80s. I don't know what year this was lifted, but that is insane. It's insane.
Yeah, exactly. So my next note is in 1981. Do you have anything else before 1981?
Yes. So in 1976, the Family Home Protection Act was enacted, and that was something where the husband could sell or mortgage the family home without the consent or even knowledge of his wife.
Yep.
Just think about... And again, okay, so if you're looking at all of these things from the perspective of a very, very, very healthy relationship and marriage, then it's probably fine because you have two people who are, you know, considerate of the other person. But if you start inching in towards perhaps an abusive relationship in any way, think about how quickly this could leave a woman with no assets, no money, because you're saying he has complete reign over the family home. That asset is gone.
Yeah.
You're saying he has complete reign over the bank accounts. That asset is gone. So he could sell your home. He could take your money, and he could leave you potentially either by yourself or with children with zero assets and zero legal recourse to do anything.
Yeah.
That is scary.
That's horrifying.
That's so scary.
Yeah, to live in a marriage like that would be very horrifying, and especially now that divorce would be legal, it's also, you're still kind of trapped in that, you know, I can't leave, because what would I have?
Yeah, you'd have
you're
nothing.
You're forcing women to stay in potentially abusive,
dangerous
relationships.
I mean, and even now, they recommend that women have what's called a fuck-off fund. So even now, it's what it's called. It's a fuck-off fund.
I've never heard that before.
Which, I mean, I'm in a completely healthy relationship with somebody who I love and we communicate very well, but I will always have a fuck-off fund, which is basically like, if anything ever were to happen or change, I have a cushion of money that is mine that can't be touched by anybody else, that I can do with what I want. And
that's
like,
a great idea.
They recommend that women nowadays have that. And that wasn't even an option for women in Ireland
up
until the 70s.
You couldn't withhold any money from your husband.
Yeah, up until the late 70s, which is insane. Okay, yeah.
So I found it interesting that until 1981, a man could sue any person who had sexual relations with his wife.
Yes, even if it was consenting. So if she cheats on you, you can sue that dude.
Yeah, for real. And it's like, but it says if the couple was already separated, the husband can only sue if separation was caused by the infidelity. I just want to picture the room in which this was discussed. By government peoples.
By a bunch of dudes.
By a bunch of dudes. They were like, you know what sounds good? My wife cheated on me, and I really want to sue the bastard.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
So we're going to put this in the Constitution. It's going to be a thing. But
And everyone was like, yes. That sounds reasonable.
Yes. It definitely makes sense. But then it's like, oh, but if you're already separated, But it,
as
it was
long
the cause.
As it wasn't a result of her cheating on you, which is so crazy to me. So the dude can cheat on her. Does she have any legal recourse to be like, I can sue that woman you were fucking? Like, no. And it's so insane because it so clearly illustrates that women are looked at as property.
Yeah.
You own her.
You touched my toy. I'm going to hurt you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's so fucking weird and childish.
Yeah.
And honestly,
I'm just picturing giant white toddler men.
Yes.
Like,
And I was angry before I even started drinking whiskey. And, like, I'm getting just pure Irish anger out now. You know what I mean? But,
Keegan's Irish now, guys.
I'm about to be legally married, so,
My ex's brother-in-law's mother, I asked if she was Irish, and she once said, no, but I've had a lot of Irish in me. And I was yes.
Excellent joke. Yeah, I just think that it is so fucking weird, and this might be the whiskey talking, but I'm like, this is why men shouldn't make decisions.
Yeah.
Because this is such a fucking weird law.
I know.
To be like, it's... this is my property. Like,
yeah.
I just cannot imagine looking at another human being and being like, you are so much lower than me that I can own you physically.
Yeah.
Like, that is crazy.
But it's crazy for us to think about, but at the same time, that's our history.
I know.
History. That's everything. You know, a woman was a man's property up until very recently, and I think that there are still a lot of relationships and places in our country that operate that way.
Well, I mean, and so much of it is deeply, I mean, we're not going to get back on this topic, but it is so deeply entrenched in theology and, like, religion. Like, it really is.
I agree. I mean, we talked last week when we were talking about Matilda Jocelyn Gage and how she believed in separation of church and state, and that was very much a lot of her reasoning for it. And, you know, she went through, you know, she helped write the women's Bible because she believed that when she was going through the Bible that it was very rooted in the patriarchy.
Yeah.
You know?
And I do want to put a disclaimer here and say that, listen, I was raised very Christian in a lot of ways.
Oh my God, you were?
Oh my God.
I've never heard that on the show before.
And in a lot of ways, I think it did me good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it did me good in a lot of ways. And so I just want to do a disclaimer here because I know for a fact that we have listeners who are practicing Christians.
Oh, yeah. We're not saying that because your religion believes this that you believe it.
Yeah. Or even that your religion is wrong or you're bad for believing it or any of that. Like, none of that is what we're trying to get at here.
A lot of this is very based on our personal experiences.
Based on our personal experiences. Yeah. And I definitely don't want to, I don't want to call anybody out or make anybody feel self-conscious about your belief system.
No, I am one of those people when it comes to religion where I'm fascinated by people's beliefs. I will sit and listen to anybody's beliefs and how they think about the world with a very non-judgmental stance. I am not judging anybody for their beliefs or what their lives are like. If it's working for you, I say do it, and that's what feminism is.
Yeah,
you know
agree.
What I mean?
I agree.
So I'm on to work and wage gap next. What do you have anything
Perfect.
To add?
Let's do it.
Let's talk about work and wage gap. So like we said, the marriage bar was lifted in 1973. The Employment Equality Act in 1977 prohibited most gender discrimination in employment. And then there was another act in 1998 to uphold this. That, to me, seems like one of those things, again, I'm not Irish, I don't know anything about Irish history, but that seems like something to appease people, where it's like, you know what, we're going to end discrimination in employment, but then I'm sure there was a lot of loopholes.
Well, and I also want to know what most means. Like, what does that mean? Because it says the Employment Equality Act of 1977 prohibited most gender discrimination in employment. Like,
and
what does that mean? So there had to have been instances in which it was still acceptable. So, like, what...
That's what I'm
what
saying.
Were those
I feel like
instances?
That, I feel like that law was created with loopholes in mind.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, there's still going to be discrimination, but it's like, we're going to do this to, like, appease a little bit. But it was upheld in 1998, which makes a lot of sense to me that maybe it was revised and things like that. So the female employment rates stretched to 60.6% in 2007.
I found this very interesting. I actually highlighted this in my notes because I want everyone to listen very closely to this because I would love to get the numbers in other developed countries, particularly in the United States, since that's what we have familiarity with, and compare. Mm-hmm. Because to me, these percentages seemed crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Because in my life, in my very personal experience, like just anecdotal experience.
Everyone has jobs.
Most women I know work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most women I know work.
I don't think I have any friends who just like,
I mean, my mom doesn't work, but like the majority of women that I know work.
Yeah.
So it is crazy
to me. And the fact that that was like, we skyrocketed to 60.6%, guys.
Right.
In 2007.
Right.
Is bonkers crazy to me. But
yes.
Then it began to decrease. By the time we hit 2012, the rate was at 52.2%.
Yeah. So it It goes from the female employment rate goes from 60.6% in 2007, slowly begins decreasing to 57.6% in 2009, and then continued to reduce.
Yeah.
To 55.2% in 2012.
But, like, fucking why? And they do say that women typically work less hours per week than men. And then there's the whole single mother thing because there's, like, lack of preschool and daycare available, which makes sense. But it's, like, I'm just confused. Like, why is there this decrease?
I guess if you look at it, I don't know why there's necessarily a decrease. I think the fact that even at its peak, it was only 10% higher than half. Which is low to us.
Yeah.
But I do think if you look at it in the context of how slowly a lot of their things moved.
Oh, for sure.
Wherein in 1973 was the first time that married women could work legally. I think that kind of illustrates why it's so much lower, because I think in the 1970s in the United States, working women were far, far, far more common, and working married women between like the second and third waves in the United States, we were looking at the have it all woman, right? The kind of like lean in woman where you can be a wife and mother and also have a job. And we've kind of moved away from that as like fourth wave feminists because we realize it's not entirely realistic.
Right.
But that was kind of the mentality for, like, second wave and third wave feminisms. I mean, feminism, you look at Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, where that's basically her whole argument is that, like, housewives should be able to have jobs outside of the home in the 60s and 70s. And in Ireland, they didn't have that because they weren't given that right.
They weren't
legally
given an opportunity
until the 70s.
Well, this is interesting. So this is from the Women's Bureau. It says, this is for the United States. It says, of the 123 million women aged 16 years and over in the U.S., 72 million or 58.6% were labor force participants working or looking for work. Women comprised 47% of the total U.S. labor force. Women are projected to account for 51% of the increase in total labor force growth between 2008 and 2018.
So if we're judging by that, then the number is lower, but I just don't...
That doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense to me either, but we could be wrong. We'll look into this more.
We could totally be wrong, but I found it really interesting where kind of like in the U.S., and I'm sure a lot of other parts of the world, the risk of poverty and a lack of a job for single women is especially difficult, especially apparently, I did not know this, but in Ireland, there is a lack of available preschool and daycare for a lot of people.
I totally believe
and
that.
And I know that that's an issue in the U.S.
It
as
is.
Well.
Yes.
And just imagine, like, the odds are already stacked against you, and then you've got a child, which, you know, back in the day, couldn't abort it, you couldn't prevent it, you couldn't,
right.
You know.
You had no recourse.
You've got
at all.
This kid, and then they're telling you to go work, you know. Again, I'm jumping in the timeline when I make that statement, but still.
But yeah, I mean, that totally makes sense.
Yeah. But it says that the wage gap, according to Eurostat data, the wage gap between men and women is 14%, and women earn 86% of men's pay.
86?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
What are we 73?
I think we're lower than 86.
Damn.
I believe. Or we were. I don't know if there's a recent stat on that.
Yeah.
That's something worth looking into. In fact, I think that we should probably have a wage gap episode at some point.
We definitely should. I remember when I was in college, just because I thought I was super funny, someone asked me for a dollar and I gave him 73 cents.
Yes, exactly. Hey. You're like, I make less than you, so how about that? How about that?
Yeah, I've actually gone through all my notes. Is there anything that you want
to
add?
The only other thing that I wanted to point out is with all of this and with having looked at that, it looks like maybe the U.S., it's easy for us, I think, to be like, oh my God, the U.S. is so much further advanced, but it doesn't seem that way when if those stats are true about working women, at least.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily seem that way. But whenever I was doing these notes, it definitely felt that way to me.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of surprising to me when I found out that in 1990, the year that I was fucking born, Mary Robinson was elected to be the first female president of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And the second president, Mary McAleese, I'm so sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, McAleese was president between between 1997 and 2001, which is a very long time to be president.
Yeah.
But they've had at least two female presidents.
Although I did read that it's like one in three parliament members are women, which honestly doesn't sound that bad, but still
one
not
third,
great.
I mean,
a third is really
not that bad.
Not horrible. But, you know, kind of like we said earlier, it's like women need to be making more decisions.
Clearly.
In all countries.
Fucking like, clearly.
The history of this shit is absolutely
ridiculous. Y'all can't be trusted
at
all.
You can't be trusted to make decisions for us.
Making fucking petty-ass laws about, like, being able to sue your wife's, like, fuckboy or whatever. Like, what's happening?
Oh, and I mean, just looking at reproductive laws and everything, I mean, I think that learning more about Irish feminism just kind of highlights a lot of the things that people in the U.S. think about. I mean, a lot of it very much mirrored what our history is and a lot of the things that I think, you know, men in our comment sections still believe.
Absolutely. I mean, well, all of these kind of Western cultures, especially those that are based on these religions, like Christianity or Catholicism or whatever, they're patriarchal in nature.
Yeah.
So a lot of that is going to leak through in other aspects of your life.
Right. And again, that's what I found so fascinating about Ireland in general is because there was no separation of church and state. The church was very much a very big part of their culture. And I know that the church has definitely decreased in its power throughout the years. So I actually knew someone who went on a Catholic mission trip to Ireland.
Interesting.
And I was like, don't they have enough Catholicism there? And I asked, so my friend Lucia would be a princess if they still had royalty in Ireland, mm-hmm. which is fucking bonkers to me. And she's like, oh, no, like, Protestants are, like, the up-and-coming now.
Well, I mean, that's what, I'm so sorry, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't know anything about Irish history, really, but, I mean, I do know that that's the big conflict, is Protestants
and
Catholics. Yeah. So, I mean, that makes sense.
I found it interesting. I'm like, you're trying to bring back these, like, old-school laws? I don't know. I was just very
confused. Because you believe in it. I mean, that's
by
the whole
that
thing.
Mission trip. I was like, you're going to Ireland for a Catholic
mission? That just seems like it's somewhere you wanted
trip?
To go to have, like, funsies to me.
Right? Well, she met her husband, and now she's married, so.
Yeah. But, I mean,
there you go.
That was the goal. Come
there
on.
There you have it.
You
I know,
wanted
we
to meet someone
like,
with an accent.
We she's so Catholic. We're like, you're going to go on this trip and you're going to meet your future husband.
Yeah.
And sure enough, she fucking
yeah,
did,
you
so.
Wanted to meet somebody with an accent. Let's be real. It wasn't
He's Scottish, I think.
To spread God's good message. Anyway.
All right, you guys. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Again, apologies for all the things we probably got wrong. We're not historians.
Yes,
you guys know that.
And please correct us. Please,
please.
If you live in Ireland, we want to hear from you. If we got some shit wrong, please. We will definitely correct ourselves in a future episode.
And I want to know more about what's happening now and how a lot of these issues are still affecting your lives now in Ireland. I just find it so fascinating because it's hard for a country to completely change its ideology so quickly. Especially when it's like, you know, your parents could have grown up in this time. You know, it's very interesting to me. So please let us know if you want to give us any feedback or ask us any questions, send us any stories. You can reach us at our email address at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com. Check out our Instagram. You can DM us there as well at Angry Neighborhood Feminist. Most of our shit happens on Instagram. If you feel like it, you can follow us on Twitter. We are at YANF Podcast,
Y-A-N-F,
beautiful, Keegan.
Thank you.
Podcast. And then we also have a Facebook business and group page. You can also leave us a review on our business page on Facebook as well as Apple Podcasts. They make our day, they make our week, they make our lives. We love it so much. Thank you. You'll be featured on Reviews Day Tuesday. You guys, we're also going to be having our coming out episode again coming up, which was something that we really enjoyed doing last year. So to kind of preempt all that, if you want to start sending us your coming out stories, please do. You can email them, DM us, whatever you want to do. Yeah, all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
I always end that horribly. I'm like, so yeah.
Well, I always want to make sure we've covered all of our bases.
Exactly.
Which
I think
we did.
Think about it.
I think we did.
You guys, thank you so much again for listening. With all of that being said, we encourage you
to rage on.
Later.